Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is Neat. It's a weekly boozecast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
All right. This is going to be a real cool episode, I think.
Oh, you already stole my only pun.
That was it?
That was it. Oh, I don't think I have anything else.
That was pretty cold of me, huh?
Oh my God, really? Man. Must you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're this week, among other things, we're talking a little bit about ice, baby.
Hey, that was good.
It's not really a pun, though, so it doesn't count. So this is inspired by one of our Patreon supporters asked us a question. Jesse asked us, well, first of all, Jesse said something really nice. Jesse said, "Hi, Neat is such a good podcast. Thank you for making it. You're welcome. I'd love to know more about ice. I've made drinks with ice from plastic trays in my freezer, but then I see people who know more about cocktails than I do saying things like, I'd rather have bad spirits and good ice than the other way around and talk about all kinds of fancy ways to make ice. I don't know if my ice is any good. Am I missing out by using normal ice? Also, I'd be interested in the history and role of ice in drinks more generally. Again, thanks for making such a fun and interesting podcast." Aw, thanks, Jesse.
Thank you, Jesse.
That was so cool. So I'm gonna answer your ice question.
All right.
Yeah. So people have actually been using ice to preserve food as far back as 1000 BCE, but you had to harvest it. And using ice as part of the food or drink experience was reserved for the lavishly rich. Using ice as means to cool drinks was considered a mark of excessive and flamboyant luxury. In the 16th century, Henry III brought piles of snow into his court to chill wine in the style of the Romans did back in the Roman Empire. And that was thought to be in poor taste. But then everybody was really jazzed about it and they wanted it. So even in the early days of the United States, Thomas Jefferson built an ice house after seeing one on his travels in Europe. And he convinced George Washington to build one, too. It was just the cool thing to do.
Oh, I see.
So ice was really only available to the wealthy until the 1800s when Frederick Tudor got the idea that ice was going to make him rich. But when he started his ice shipping business, he could barely sell 80 pounds of ice at a tropical port in the West Indies. You know, that's saying everybody wants a glass of ice water in hell. Guess not.
But not in the West Indies.
Not in the West Indies.
No.
Not in the West Indies. Wow. No. They thought it was super sus. They were like, what's this guy bringing ice here?
Yeah, we've learned to live without ice all this time.
We don't need that.
Why would we buy that?
Yeah, no. So they didn't buy it. He had to give it away for free at first, convinced that if people tried it, they would be hooked. And it kind of worked. So by the mid-1800s, he was shipping over 50,000 tons of ice across the U.S., and they developed a process of cutting the ice with horse-drawn saws, which saved a lot of laborers from getting hurt. Because ice cutting was really hard work and risky business, because the slabs of ice they were cutting could be up to 400 pounds, and sliding them could result in limbs getting crushed.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so it made it safer, and it lowered the cost of ice because it's more efficient.
That's what that one nice boy from Frozen did, right? The one that was raised by trolls.
You're right. The nice boy.
The nice boy.
You know,
that I can't remember his name.
Nice boy.
The nice boy. Plays guitar. The nice talks boy to a moose.
Talks to moose. Talks to mooses. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't remember. I was going to say Sven, but I think that's the moose.
I remember the moose's name. I don't remember the nice boy's name. Nice ice boy.
Nice ice boy.
Okay.
Don't at me. I don't remember it. It's been a while since I...
Kevin.
Kevin, the ice boy and his moose friend.
Yes.
Sven.
All right.
So
he had a dangerous job.
Yeah, he had a dangerous job. But Now that it was a little bit safer and a little bit more affordable, ice houses are popping up all over, and they even invented insulated carriages and train cars to carry it across the country. And everybody is losing their shit over ice. By the time Frederick Tudor dies, rich, by the way.
So it worked out.
Yeah, it worked out. Right. Everybody with access to a frozen body of water was getting in on the action. Although it still wasn't a risk-free endeavor, because you're still counting on harvesting a naturally occurring resource. So, you know, sometimes it's not cold enough, so you can't get the ice and there's an ice famine. Or sometimes it's not hot enough and nobody cares about your gosh dang ice, and then you're ruined financially. It's a big gamble.
Yeah.
Yeah. And by 1867, as a result of an invention made by Dr. John Gorey, the first commercial ice-making machine was developed by Andrew Mull to help the Texas beef industry. So pretty soon, everybody has an ice box, especially if you're a barkeep.
Mm.
And access to ice changed cocktails. It completely changed them. Ice became a big element in the presentation of cocktails. Part of the flair was how cold you could serve it, which is where we got like the mountain of shaved ice and juleps, the metal cups that would frost up to show you how cold that drink was, using so much ice that you could even top it with whatever seasonal fruit was available. And foreigners were astounded by the frivolous way Americans flaunted our clean ice. People are losing their minds.
I feel like that's still kind of true. Like, we have a lot of, everything gets served with ice in America.
We like things cold so you can't actually taste it.
Maybe that's true.
Yeah. But like the cocktail itself also had to change because of ice, because before they were watered down a little bit to cut the harshness of the liquor and to integrate the sugar, but now the ice made it difficult for sugar to melt. And also as the ice melted, it watered down the cocktail even more. So we took out the extra water, and to solve the sugar problem, that's why we made simple syrups and started using fruit syrups too.
Nice.
Yeah. Pretty cool. Ice contributes around 25% of the volume of a cocktail, and when shaken and strained, it not only integrates a little water by melting, it also chills the liquor and cuts the harshness of the flavor.
Right.
Which is what we were doing before by watering it down, but this time it's like, also it's cold, so, you know, we can't taste it as much. Then Prohibition happens. Wah, wah, wah.
Every tale of any element of alcohol history, there's always the "and then Prohibition" moment.
Right. So people aren't concerned so much with their drink being chilled. They just want a fucking drink. So while Prohibition is going on, there's the development of safe-to-use Freon, and they're developing freezers and refrigerators, which is kind of cool to think about, because the ice craze created the need for the technology that ultimately was the downfall of the ice industry. So, because now people can get ice in their own home.
Yeah.
So at the end of Prohibition, just about 1% of Americans had a freezer in their home, but by 1950, that number grew to 80%, just in time for the end of World War II and the return of the cocktail.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Speaking of World War II, there's a funny rumor going around that the icemen who deliver the ice were getting a little too friendly with the wives of the fellows that were out serving the war.
Oh, I thought that was the milkman. It was the icemen.
It was the icemen. So when the fellows got home, they were anxious to get a refrigerator and get rid of their ice boxes, as well as those randy icemen.
They couldn't compete with those chill dudes.
Oh, man, you did it again. You did it again. The hits just keep on coming.
Sorry.
It's okay. No, I'm glad you're filling that space, because I was like, I can't think of anything else to say. But guess what? Now, ice had changed. People weren't really interested in the presentation of ice, just the cooling effects. And they thought it was pretty cool that they could just get it in their home and didn't have to have it delivered.
Nice.
This ice was much more convenient, but not necessarily better. It wasn't the big, beautiful, clear cubes that took a long time to melt. They were cloudy and unstable, so they melted very quickly. But that was what industry kind of just did to America. We choose convenience over quality, and nobody gave a shit because they didn't have the time. Nobody's got time, you know? Until the craft cocktail movement.
There it is.
Which was pretty recent when you think about it, just like in the last 20 years. So in 2010, one of the first bars to bring back an ice program was Weather Up, which I believe is in New York. There's a few different locations, but I think the one that they're talking about is in New York. All of a sudden, bartenders become very interested in figuring out how to create clear ice without having to cut it from a 300-pound block. You know, that's a lot. So commercial ice making companies, who before were like just about on their way out, came back to serve that demand, and now we've got ice chisels and tappers and sometimes chainsaws and different shapes of ice, like spheres and those silicone ice trains, all sorts of hullabaloo behind the
diamonds.
Bar.
I once saw a man carve a diamond.
No.
Yeah.
A diamond out of ice?
A diamond out of ice.
Wow, yeah. I mean, now ice is part of the experience of a craft cocktail, once again, and even more so. If you're going to put ice in a drink, it's got to be aesthetic, and you can get crazy, get creative, put stuff in your ice, fruit, flowers, plastic dinosaurs. I don't know if that's a real thing. It's just something that I thought about could be like a prize. Yeah. It would be cool. I think it would be cool. You could flavor your ice. You can color your ice. You had a drink at Deacon Giles in Salem where they put activated charcoal on the ice, and it changed the color of your drink over time.
Yeah, it was a really smart way. Activated charcoal, which of course has questionable legality in use because it does inhibit the ability of certain medications. So, you know, think about it before you consume it or use it in your bar.
I don't think they can use it in New York.
I don't think we can. I'm pretty sure it's been outlawed. But yeah. Even if you can,
it was cool though.
Know the facts around it. But when you do make things with it with a cocktail, like serving a pitch black drink sounds cool, but it looks a little questionable in the glass. Yeah. But this drink started out like a really nice sunny yellow, and then slowly turned like green to black, and that was cool.
That was really cool.
Yeah, freezing the charcoal in, like, it was just a layer of the charcoal in the ice cube, so it like slowly integrated. It was really great use of ice.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you know, even there's like some crafty bartenders who put the cocktail inside the ice cube.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how the science behind that works, but cool. Then one other thing that I found, that if you use a large cube to shake a drink, like in a shaker instead of little ice cubes, it can agitate better. So if you're using something that foams, it creates a little bit more froth for you. Mm. But yeah, basically the possibilities are endless.
Well, and I'm going to kind of expound on that, because we thought a good kind of complimentary lesson with this was to talk about shaking in general. So I'm going to tell you all about that. But I do want to like meditate a bit on Jesse's question. Is it better to have good ice and bad spirits?
Hmm.
I would say unequivocally no. just because, like you said, about a quarter of a drink is ice or dilutant or water.
That means that 75% is the
other stuff.
And
now, but it is an ingredient. So if you have gross water, it would follow suit that you would have a gross ingredient in your cocktail. And you should have, like, using pure water, like using filtered water, making your ice with that will definitely produce better ice. If you're wondering about the... There are a couple ways to get clear ice cubes for the aesthetics. The most basic way is you're boiling the water first to remove all the air bubbles. And then you definitely want to cover your ice when it's freezing to make sure no particles fall into it. So clear ice, you know, is usually... I've made it by boiling it in the past. There are other ways to do it. There are other methods.
Yeah, you want to protect your ice, especially if you got other shit in your freezer, like cheese and broccoli and stuff, you know. You gotta...
Who freezes cheese?
My mom.
Okay, all right.
for safekeeping. And, you know, you got to hang on to that cheese for later.
Well, and that's, but that is a good point because ice takes on flavors of anything else that's around it.
Right.
So you can, so yeah, so you have a freezer full of weird stinky food and you have your ice in there, your ice will pick up those flavors. Also, ice can burn over time. Like old ice.
Oh, right. Like just, freezer burn.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I was confused for a
no, not like second. Set on fire.
Okay.
So yeah, so it is something to consider, like ice that's been in the back of like a stinky fridge and then you put it in your cocktail. But I think I would take stinky ice over like bathtub gin over like the most like gross.
We haven't even
like,
talked
upset.
About that.
Yeah,
yet.
Like I think I would take bad ice over that. But your friends that say that aren't, that might be hyperbole, but they're not, their point is fair, that a lot of people just think, it's ice, all ice is the same. That's absolutely not true. Mm-hmm. It can carry flavor, it can carry particles, so.
Yeah, and you don't want ice that you don't want like the hotel ice, like vending machine ice, because that melts really fast mm-hmm. and it's like, you know, it's no good.
Oh, I've definitely made cocktails with hotel ice on trips, and that's, you know.
It's not nice.
Yeah, it's not the best showing of my skills. But you know, because hey, that ice breaks down in a shaker really quickly. So cocktail shakers are pretty essential when we're talking about ice in cocktails. You might think that shakers would have been an invention of the 19th century, like around the time that cocktails are coming into our understanding. But actually the shaker predates our more modern understanding of cocktail.
Ah, we've been shaking for a while.
We have been.
We're movers and shakers.
We hey, there you got one.
It's worse when you point out when I get one.
I just want you to feel good about yourself.
I have to edit this later. I have to listen to myself. There's no way that I'm going to feel good about myself.
Oh, okay.
It's okay.
All right. So,
yeah.
The cocktail shaker, we have evidence of like remnants of hollowed out gourds with like they've found had like traces of alcohol on them, and studies suggest people probably use them to unify some sort of drink.
Ooh.
And these were found in like South America and they date back to like 7000 BC.
Wow.
So yeah. And then like kind of forwards from there, in Egypt around like 3500 BC, they were using some sort of containers to mingle spices into their fermented beverages. In more modern times, in like the 1500s, Spanish conquistador Hernando Cortes wrote a letter to King Charles V about like golden cylinders that were used to combine beverages to make them foamy and frothy for Montezuma.
Ooh, yeah. That sounds suspiciously like a modern day shaker.
It does. And you know, these the at some point the knowledge dropped off or something, because then, you know, you fast forward to like the 19th century when cocktails are becoming a thing and you have people using methods to combine liquors, but nobody is shaking them. In the 19th century, you kind of had two ways that you were combining cocktails. One, which needs no explanation, is stirring cocktails.
Right.
And then
the traditional method, you might say.
Yeah. The other one is something that we would now refer to as rolling.
Ooh.
So rolling,
that sounds fun.
Yeah, we still use it today. Rolling is basically having like two cups and just transporting the cocktail back and forth between them.
Yeah. Kind of like folding is to mixing in culinary arts as like rolling would be to shaking.
Yeah.
Like it's a gentler way to combine things.
And we use it nowadays. Like I've used it for like Bloody Marys, for drinks you don't really want to add dilution to, because you're really just kind of integrating the ingredients. You're not really chilling them. You're not really diluting them. Like nobody really wants ice chips in their Bloody Mary, you know, or like aeration in their Bloody Mary, or for like a drink that just, it's kind of like a Moscow Mule or something that has like a soda element to it, and you're just trying to combine the ingredients, like a drink
definitely
that you
can't shake that.
No, I like a drink that you build in the glass, but you want to take that extra moment to like make sure that everything's combined together. Mm-hmm. You might roll it gently from like a shaker tin to the back to the glass. But this was the way that any cocktail that wasn't stirred was made. It was rolled at the time. Now, as the fable, the story, the legend goes, because of course there's no there's no like traceable moment
we
to this. Know.
We just didn't write it down.
It's bartenders. It's lies and lore. But supposedly there was an innkeeper who was rolling a cocktail, and he realized that the two glasses he'd chosen, the mouth of one fit snugly into the mouth of the other. So one was a little smaller than the other. So he locked them together and shook them to kind of make a show of it.
Oh, he was showing off, right?
Yeah, just found, you know, like, oh, look at this. I can do this. And realized it made a better drink. And so that idea caught on.
Hey.
So somebody figured it out. Like, I don't, you know. But from there, we have evidence. The first patent was issued in December of 1972. And then kind of a slew of patents follow that, improving on the idea of a cocktail shaker, adding elements, better locking qualities, filters.
All the fancy tools that we get to use now. I don't know the names of most of them.
Well, this
like, can you hand me that?
The thing.
The strainer? Yes, the thing.
Strainer, yes. Yeah. You know. Well, and these improvements continue up to the 1920s, and that's when shakers really come into style. Now, one big reason, you mentioned Prohibition about ice, but one
as
thing...
As we do every time.
Prohibition has a place in shaker history, too. So one thing that is interesting as far as the cocktail landscape that happens during Prohibition is because we are dealing with different kind of liquors, we're getting, you know, moonshine and bathtub gin. We're getting kind of rougher spirits than we were used to, you know.
Yeah.
The old standard for a cocktail was usually something that was very liquor forward. It was stirred. It was, you were meant to taste the alcohol. You really wanted to be able to focus on that flavor profile. Prohibition, we're working with whatever we've got, and sometimes what we've got is rough stuff. So, but you find that so you start adding things in to cover it up a lot more.
Geez, I wish we had some ice to chill this out. So
I
want to chase this liquor.
Oh, you want to add ice? You want to add juice? You want to add sometimes cream? Sometimes eggs? Like, you're adding whatever you can.
That's where that came from.
Yeah. So it's like, this is becomes like wildly popular to just add whatever you can to kind of mask what you have to work with.
Oh.
And the shaker's great at that.
So that's why we get all of these like weird cocktails from that period, because we're actually trying to kind of cover up the funky booze that we're using.
It wasn't unheard of to use these things in cocktails before that, but the popularity of them takes on kind of in the, you know, the speakeasy underground, because they're great ways of treating spirits that you don't really want to taste. You don't want to get the full bouquet of your like radiator moonshine. You don't want that, you know? Like, no, make a sour, throw some citrus, throw an egg white in there.
Not the bouquet of the radiator.
You know, Well, and of course, alongside of this very practical reason, it also just kind of becomes synonymous with the style of the jazz age. Like, it was just important to know your cool shake technique was on par with your the new dance craze.
Charleston.
Like, yeah.
you just hold a shaker in one hand and you do the Charleston, a little bit of Lindy Hop, and it shook.
That's how you be cool. Look at that stylish blast.
Yeah. Yeah,
shaker in one hand and Charleston. And
it's the new craze.
it's
all the rage.
Well, and this, you know, and it really does kind of like, because this is around this time is when you have some really ridiculous examples of shaking taking place. Just like shortly after this, you get the birth of, and we'll have to do an entire episode on this drink at some point, but if you've ever heard of a Ramos Gin Fizz. It's a New Orleans born cocktail. It's an egg white drink. And it's supposed to be shaken for like 5 minutes. They would make a show of it and have like a line of barmen behind the bar, and pass it, like you'd shake it for as long as you can hand and then pass it to somebody else. So it was a whole show of like how long you'd shake it to make it the frothiest, most like, because the drink goes, it's shaken over, well, it's shaken two ways. We'll cover that in the video. But the drink itself goes into like a tall glass with no ice in it. So you're really kind of relying on a lot of foam to fill up the volume, and then you're adding some soda. Yeah, so shaking is very much like it's a cultural thing, it's a style thing, and this only extends after Prohibition. After Prohibition, it's a staple of like in every, you know, Hollywood, in every like movie.
Yeah.
Where you're trying to establish like a cool character, a stylish, sophisticated character. like cocktail shakers become synonymous in the image of Hollywood mm-hmm. with style and class.
Right. It's also like something, you know, it's great to give somebody a prop and let them do a little show business yeah. there.
Well, they kind of, you know, because a shaker becomes such like a cool thing, they make them in really like inventive, stylish ways. I thought this was like a modern thing because I myself have a penguin shaped cocktail thing.
Oh yeah. Shaker.
I thought that was like a cool, like a modern, like just a novelty thing. This is actually the time period that you start seeing the penguin shaker. It dates back to like the 20s and 30s.
Oh my God, that's so cool. Yeah. Is yours that old?
No, mine is not. Mine was bought new. But they would like design them to look like airplanes or penguins or zeppelins.
Oh, I've seen the airplane ones. That's so cool. So
I kind of like that it's a bit of history that style was actually developed in this craze around like cocktail shakers as like a cool element to have.
Oh my God, I'm going to Google it now. I want to see all the different ones. Well, not right now. I'll
finish. We gotta finish the podcast first, man.
I'm just so excited.
but outside of the novelty shapes, obviously different styles of shakers for like the integrity of how they can be used and their efficiency in making a cocktail are developed. Styles of shakers that bartenders still squabble over today as far as what works best, which I'll go into a little later.
Okay.
Now, of course, as you mentioned, the follow-up to whatever happens to alcohol and alcohol's attributes in Prohibition, something else happens during wartime. And so for shakers, it was not so good.
No.
A lot of the companies, especially for World War II, like starting in 1941, a lot of the companies, manufacturers that were making shakers, all excess metals had to go towards the war effort.
That's right. Like women were giving the metal from their corsets and stuff. Mm-hmm.
And their stockings were going to, yeah.
Yeah, there's not scrap metal in stockings?
No, but the nylon for the stockings.
Oh, the nylon. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, fashion changed, drinking changed.
Everything changed.
Yeah. But that's what a lot of these places that were making shakers were now making artillery shells.
They're doing okay. They're still in business. Yeah, you know. They're just not making the same thing.
But that definitely dealt a blow to it. Now, of course, after war, you know, soldiers returning home, there was a bit of a return to norm in the 50s. It was kind of a staple of, you know, your Don Drapers, that kind of movement.
Yeah.
Shakers were back. They were in everybody's rec room.
His martinis.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yeah. The old, and that's the three martini lunch. You'd shake it and you'd leave it and you let it kind of like melt a little bit in your shaker and you'd just serve it out of that.
Well, that's a little bit more responsible than every martini you have is a little bit less alcohol.
Yeah.
Weenie off a little bit. Yeah, so you're not, so you're just a little bit drunk by the end of lunch.
But unfortunately, this quick revival was put to an end by two forces of cultural change, one of which, one of the big reasons that like cocktail culture doesn't pick back up in the 50s is because you then move into the 60s and 70s where you have generations of people that wanted nothing to do with what their parents drank.
Yeah.
So much the same, like they didn't want to pick up their parents' drinking habits. The shaker didn't catch on with the young crowd.
Right. They're not going to be pushing around that little martini cart.
No, that was lame old, lame.
What did they call them?
Old, I don't know.
Those nifties. Those
nifties?
I don't know. What do you call them?
Lame old men, old straight people. I don't know.
I don't know. Tell us what the children of the 70s
squares?
Called squares.
So that was the thing that your square dad would do.
Square dad, square old man. Yeah, you're right. That's it. Okay. Take it back. Pretend we didn't say. Pretend we know.
We'll cut some of that out.
No. No. We're keeping all of it. Square old man.
Yeah. Well, and outside of the cultural reasoning, more to the point, blenders were also invented.
Oh, right.
So you kind of had a death to the classic, the inherited culture, and then the blender created a new way of chilling drinks and adding ice and
integrating it.
Whole new culture around it. You know, this is when we move into kind of the convenience age, and so it just seemed like a better way of doing things.
Right. Yeah. Faster, electronic, automatic.
Yeah.
Supersonic. Hypnotic, funky fresh.
All of these. Yes. But of course, as you mentioned, in the 90s, we had the beginnings of the classic cocktail movement. Mm-hmm. Shakers came back into style. Proper shaking techniques became focused again. And now, you know, that's why we have the wealth of available tins and information that we have today.
Cute.
Yeah. So on those three styles that I mentioned earlier, just a quick rundown of what you'll see out there. The most common one you'll see behind the bar is called a Boston shaker.
A Boston shaker.
Yep. And that is the one that can either be a pint glass locked with a metal tin or two metal tins.
Okay.
I like the two tins because sometimes when your tins lock, you kind of have to tap them. And when you've got glass involved, tapping anything is scary, especially chilled glass. Oh,
okay. All right.
Yeah.
Don't. I see what you mean. My first thought was that I prefer the pint glass and the metal because it's easier to get them apart. But you're right. If you tap it, then why wouldn't you just tap the metal one?
Well, there's still glass in there. So that could shatter your.
All right.
Yeah, there's still glass in. I don't go. In a bar, glass breaks. Everything is ruined.
I understand.
Forever. But yeah, I mean, there is a benefit to the glass part. You can see your measurements more easily, which is nice.
So that's the Boston shaker.
That's the most common one you'll find behind mm-hmm. bars. There's also the cobbler, which you might have seen around. That's the three piece one. That was one of those things that came out of the patent craze in like the 1920s. So that's the one that has like the bottom part looks like a tin. There has a little lid on it and the lid kind of flutes and has a filter built into it.
Yeah,
and like a little cap goes over the filter. That cap is usually like marked off for an ounce or 2 ounce or something, so you can use it.
So it's like a kit. It's like a bar kit in one thing. And it's got the strainer in there, it's got the jigger in there.
Yeah. Which is nice because you don't have to have a secondary filter. You do have to have a secondary filter or a strainer for the Boston shaker. Mm-hmm. But it's not so nice behind a bar because that little cap is just another little small thing that you can lose in a dark bar.
And I often find I had one like that, and I could, when you would shake something cold and shake it well, then you couldn't get the top off.
That it was so hard. Yeah. You've got a tighter seal there.
Right.
So
then it's two cold metals against each other.
So that one can be hard to get apart. It's a little bit, even whatever time you save by not straining with a separate strainer, you lose in the fact that you have three parts to clean now mm-hmm. instead of two. So I don't know. I definitely have seen bars that are committed to cobblers, but. And then the last, which is probably the one you see the least of, I've actually never worked with one. When I was researching this, I was like, oh, that's, I would like to find one, is the French shaker. And that's kind of, it's the same, like, two-part system as the Boston shaker. It's got, like, a metal cup as the bottom, and the top is, like, just a metal top that has a bit of a flute to it. Yeah. And the idea behind, supposedly this one aerates your cocktail a little better.
Oh.
I don't know. But as far as for your home bar, any are great. And the Boston shaker is definitely the cheapest and easiest to find.
Mm-hmm. You even could just find one half of it and then just have a pint glass.
You could. Just be careful because there's glass.
Be careful.
Always
be careful.
Yeah. All right. So in closing, I do just want to give a couple reasons, a little bit of knowledge as to why we shake.
Why?
Well, it's a couple reasons. The first is texture. So we get that from emulsification and aeration. The key ingredient shaking adds that stirring does not is the addition of air. Tiny air bubbles get trapped in your solution when you shake it, and that creates a smoother texture to your beverage that kind of makes it glide across your tongue instead of sort of permeating, sink into it.
Okay.
Now, so this helps marry together liquids of varying viscosities, especially when you have those creams or eggs or juices
right.
in it. Yeah.
Okay.
Second, obviously, as you discussed, dilution. You know, how much water you're adding to your drink. Now, this can factor in differently for different drinks, like how long you shake. This is kind of crazy bartender stuff that I don't think you have to really worry about if you're making a drink at home. But, you know, if you have a drink going up, so it's going to be served over no ice, all of your dilution and all of your chill factor is going to be provided by your shake. Whereas if that same drink is going over the rocks, over ice, you probably want to shake it just a little bit less.
Right.
Because you want to dilute a little less. It's going to continue to dilute over that ice, mm-hmm. and it's going to allow the chill to last longer. So it's just something to think about if, you know, when you're, depending on what kind of vessel you're putting your drink in. And I mean, you know, that people will get also then, like, if you're adding like a topper to it, like a ginger beer or something to a drink,
right.
then you might even want to like shake it less because you've got even more dilution going into it. People get real crazy with this stuff. There are multiple kinds of shakes. There's like whip shakes where you're literally just putting a little bit of crushed ice in the bottom and just shaking it really quickly to get the max amount of concentration of your liquid. So you could really take this stuff to a highly pretentious level if you want to.
Yes, I always do.
Yeah, or you can just follow kind of a general good rule of how long to shake. Somewhere between like 12 to 18 seconds okay. is the sweet spot for most cocktails.
All right. Like I can't do two things at once, so I won't ever be counting while I'm shaking.
I mean, you know, like when I first learned how to make cocktails, and it was at a very good bar, like a very respected bar, but the head barman just said, shake it till it's cold.
Right.
And that was how I learned. Now, that does seem to happen in about 12 to 15 seconds.
Okay.
But yeah, you know, like you don't need to shake a cocktail for a minute.
Like, no.
Unless it's one of those crazy Ramos Gin Fizzes, which right. that's a whole other thing. So last, third and the most obvious is you shake it to chill it. That goes without saying. Ice obviously chills the cocktail, but shaking a cocktail will make drinks a lot colder than stirring will ever get to for the amount of dilution that you want.
Mm-hmm.
So you just get a colder beverage by shaking a drink. And definitely, like as you mentioned, our tongue picks up less when it's colder. So for those heavy booze-forward spirit drinks that you want to taste every bit of, it makes sense that we stir it. And for those light, effervescent drinks, we want the chill on it because that's more refreshing.
Yeah.
And that kind of goes into when to shake versus stir. Like I said, for it's bartender history, so for every rule we put down, there are 100 cocktails that break it and 100 bartenders that will, you know, like revolt against it. But a general rule to follow is if you have anything other than just liquor, liqueurs, and syrup in your drink, you want to shake it. So if you have citrus, if you have juice, if you have cream, if you have egg, anything other than just like a base spirit, a simple syrup, a bitter, or a liqueur, like you wanna aerate it to mm-hmm. some degree.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever met a bartender who was like always played by the rules? I would imagine that bartenders are more on the side of like, I'm a rebel, I do things my way.
See, I feel like I love bartending, but I'm also very like science brained. So like, I feel like a lot of these rules come from like a logic, like, oh, well, I want to aerate this, or I want to add like texture to this because I'm working with these ingredients and that's better. Mm-hmm. So I'm a bartender that I feel like follows the rules. Like, I'm like, well, this is why people have done it. And there's always someone like, but I like to like shake my old fashions. And I'm like, why?
Why
would you do that? I don't know.
Doesn't make sense.
And there's a history of shaking old fashions, but it's right. during the time, like the dark days of cocktails, like in the 70s when everything was made wrong. Sorry, right. 70s.
Sorry, 70s. You're just awful.
Yeah, you made toxic red maraschino cherries
right.
a thing.
So I'd say you're more of a bartender who follows logic.
Yeah.
Make it make sense.
Yeah. I think, and to that end, I think like shake it till it's cold, like stir right. it till it's cold. Is this so like, that's basically, that's a good rule to follow.
That's
like,
just science,
know.
Folks.
Yeah. I mean, and I've seen bartenders stick thermometers in their drinks and measure like
no.
the temperature at the service bar versus when it reaches the table. And I think that's cool. Like I respect that. But then there's also the, I want people to enjoy it and I want it to be practical. So yeah. those things also factor in. Work with good products, have good technique, do your research, and then just chill.
Oh man, what a perfect way to knock that out.
There you go.
Thank you to all of you out there who donated to our Patreon, and thank you so much to all our new Patreon members. We got a few this week,
yeah,
and I was really excited about that.
Welcome!
Because we use that money to pay for the supplies that we need to make these delicious cocktails for you and update our equipment. And if you want to be one of our Patreon supporters, we're going to put that link in our show notes. If you do decide to support us, you can definitely send us a booze-related question. We'll answer those like we did one today. We also have exclusive video content on our Patreon right now. Thank you to everyone who tweeted and retweeted about the show this week. That is Stephanie Cooperstein, Terry Reeves, Ladies of Strange, Amelia Walsh, Jam, Mary Smurl, Dorothy Hoover, Tommy Smurl, Michael Beck, Jennifer, Stella, Georgina Rice, Bizaster, Dr. Snoodles.
What are you a doctor of?
No, I love your name. I'm snoodling. Mia Smash, Emma Devine, Austin Wills, Allie, Jacob Shambling Corpse.
My favorite Shambling Corpse.
Yes. Marile, Varg, Sydney McElroy, Justin McElroy, Parts, the Jeremy Jerky Dinner, Spirit System, and anyone we miss, thank you so much. It terrifies me to read all of those names in one go every week.
But so, I appreciate you doing it, and I appreciate that we have so many names to read.
I'm so excited about it. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at NeatBoozeCast. I changed the Instagram so it's the same as Twitter, so nice. It's easier to find. Thank you, Absurdist, for our wonderful theme music. If you're listening on iTunes, please subscribe and give us a review. And don't forget to head over to our YouTube channel. That is going to be there tomorrow for you to check out some experiments we do with some ice and some shakers and show you some cool stuff.
Yeah, this is going to be a fun video. This is going to get inventive.
Yeah. Gonna just go crazy. We're going off the rails.
I don't know.
Anyway. Anyway.
Okay.
Tell them who you are.
Oh. That was like weirdly encouraging. Tell them who you are. In fact, well, I'm Taylor Smell.
I'm Liz June.
And this has been
Neat.